Hello and welcome. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm so excited to have you guys here today to share, so I can share with you a very, very, very special guest. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about David Winston, and I'm going to share with you his official bio, and then I'm going to share with you my experience with him. He's my main herbal teacher, mentor over the years. So David is, we just shared that he's been studying herbs for 45 years. Since the age of 13, he started studying herbs, and he became proficient and started practicing in his early 20s. So he's been at it for a really long time. He's eclectic in that he knows the Cherokee traditions, the Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic and Western stuff, and I've studied all of these with him, and the thing that I've been impressed with is he doesn't just superficially know all of these traditions. He knows these traditions, like at the bone level knows these traditions. And he's just got this working knowledge of herbs and their actions and their indications that is just beyond anybody I've met. He's been in clinical practice over 35 years. He's an herbal consultant to physicians and herbalists. And we were just chatting about how he's this guy jam-packed with teaching engagements. And we're so fortunate to get a hole in his schedule that we could get him here live. He has written a number of books, and I've got all of them. And he is the founding member of the American Herbalist Guild, where he was president for a long time. He's also on the advisory board for the American Botanical Council. And if you remember Live at Shine, Mark Blumenthal, who did that really cool, funny talk with his cartoons, that's his group. He's written books. I've got all of them, like I said, Saw Palmetto, Herbal Therapeutic Specific Indications, Adaptogens, which is a book that you all have to have on your desk. It's the best reference to adaptogens that I've seen, and then an herbal supplement, scientific and traditional approach. And he's a member of the Advisory Council for the Botanical Safety Institute. The thing that I first met David through the recordings of one of the herbal conferences, I can't remember if it was Medicines from the Earth or Gaia, and I was just intrigued. And so I went to his website, and I saw that he had these little video, they were audio tapes at the time, little cassette tapes, and I ordered all of them on every topic. And I would just, every time I was in the car, I was listening to David. And I was just so thrilled. And then somehow across my desk came this flyer that said he was going to be live doing a six-day herbal training in Maine. And I was like, whoa. Oh, no, Vermont. It's Vermont, right? And mm-hmm. I went to this for herbal training and was blown away. And I was amongst the group of students who convinced him to take his two-year training, which he was doing live in New Jersey, and none of us could attend because none of us lived in New Jersey and weren't going to travel to New Jersey once a week. We convinced him to look into doing it online, and he's been doing it that way ever since. That was back in 2006, I think, mm-hmm. that we did that, and he started the program, and I got into that. We did the two-year program, and he's been doing it ever since. And he still continues to do it, although he's just told me that this year, the one that starts in September, is going to be the last time he does it live. He does most of the training that other people are going to take it over. So without further ado, you're going to love David and all he has to share. Welcome, and thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure. So, you know, to me, it's always just a great opportunity to, you know, have a time to talk about what I love. And as you mentioned, this is what I've been doing my entire life. I think it's an incredible blessing when you find your passion and you get to actually make your living doing what you love to do. And so thank you for giving me that opportunity.
I am so thrilled. And this group came together for a live event, as I was telling you about, back in January. And it was called Scientific and Holistic Investigation of Nutritional Endocrinology. But we just call it SHINE, because we talked about lots of ways that we can shine as practitioners by really digging in deep and not having a lot of dogma about what we're doing with people, but really understanding the mechanisms of what's going on and helping people to balance the hormones, which are probably at the heart of just about every condition that we see, and using the tools that nature has to offer, but also using the scientific understanding, the biochemistry, and using testing and other things when necessary. So I would love for you to just talk to people a little bit about your approach, because I know it's so eclectic and you don't have the dogma about just use herbs or just do Chinese herbs, or you just kind of blend and use all that science and nature has to offer.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, the eclectic physicians who were basically herbal physicians who practiced in the United States from about 1825 up through about the 1930s, it's amazing. They were primarily herbal physicians in the United States up until the 1930s.
Wow.
But anyway, their name, eclectic, came from the fact that they believed that they had no dogma. At the time, there were all these various sects of medicine. You had the allopaths, which, you know, are the orthodox physicians today. You had homeopaths. You had Thomsonian practitioners. You had hydropaths. You had all these groups, and each one vehemently believed that their way of practice was the only way. And the beauty of the eclectics was, is they believed that you would be eclectic in the sense of the original term, meaning to choose the best from wherever. Instead of having a dogma that you had to, this was the only way to practice, you looked around, you saw what worked, you put it together, and that was the eclectic practice. And for me, in my training, of course, I was trained in Chinese medicine, and I've been trained in Cherokee herbal medicine, and I've been trained in Western eclectic herbal medicine. And while I haven't actually been trained in Ayurveda, I certainly know quite a bit about it. And the reality is that there's no system of medicine that has all the answers. And one of the things I tell my students in my two-year program is really work hard at avoiding hardening of the mind. Hardening of the mind is worse than hardening of the arteries. And that's when you start believing that, you know, your technique, your practice, your knowledge is the sum of all knowledge. And Samuel Thompson, who was the founder of Thomsonian medicine, that was one of the downfalls of him and his practice, was that he believed that everything that you needed to know was in his book. And as long as you could read his book and do what he said to do, that was it. And, of course, that's never the case. There's not a diet that works for everybody. There is not a bodywork technique that works for everybody. Herbs are fantastic, but they don't always work. I had somebody the other day wanting to know about what was it? This was a case that we did in class, and there was somebody with a bone spur. And they wanted to know what herb was, you know, useful for bone spurs. And the reality is herbs don't work well for bone spurs. So it comes down to knowing your limitations, and it comes down to knowing what does what well. And so, you know, in my mind, anybody who's a good – well, actually, I should change that. In my mind, anyone who wants to be a great herbalist, and whether we're talking about an herbalist or a medical doctor or a naturopathic physician or a chiropractor or whatever it is that you are going to be, don't be good. Don't be, you know, good enough. Strive to be the best that you absolutely can be. And so I try to teach my students to be great herbalists. And, of course, many of my students are already physicians or nurses or nurse practitioners or naturopathic physicians or chiropractors or nutritionists, whatever they might be. And what that means is, to be a great practitioner, obviously you need to have a tremendous depth of knowledge, yes, but there are certain things you need to know, and what you need to know goes back about 2,000 years, and it goes back to Hippocrates, who said it's more important to know the person that has the disease than the disease the person has. Mm-hmm. And so great practitioners learn how to treat people. And that means we could have five people standing in front of us, all diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. They're not five rheumatoid arthritises. They're five unique people. Rheumatoid arthritis is one thing that they may share, but even then, the energetics of the condition, the specifics of their case are different. And so those five people, from an herbal perspective, would get five different protocols. And so, yes, there may be some overlap, but in many cases, they'll be significantly different because, again, we have if we look at the statistics with something like rheumatoid arthritis, at least three or three and a half, if you could do that, would be women, since women tend to get autoimmune diseases significantly more than men. Some might be young, some might be old, some may have circulatory issues, some may have leaky gut syndrome, some may have other digestive issues, some may have sleep issues, and you treat the whole person. And so my philosophy has always been is, very much like the eclectics, to take the best from wherever. And once you understand the energetics of herbs, once you understand the human energetics, and on top of that, I would, you know, add in things like you were talking about before, science. Use science to help you to get a better understanding of what's happening. You have a much better chance of really effectively treating that person rather than throwing things at the name of a disease. And I find that so much of what is, you know, shows up as not being all that useful, like, for instance, orthodox treatment of depression, is simply because they're treating depression as depression, and they're not looking at it as hepatic depression or GI-based depression or cardiac-based depression or thyroid-based depression or HPA axis deficiency-based depression or blood sugar dysregulation-based depression. They're just looking at it, it's depression. And if you treat it as a simple, you know, it's you're depressed and take St. John's wort, the reality is you're going to be disappointed more often than you are going to be elated, because that type of therapy isn't very effective.
Yeah, it so resonates, and that's so why I chose to study with you over all the other practitioners out there, because it is so, it's so important, and we see that over and over again. As practitioners, people come to us and say, yeah, my friend referred me, and so what herb do you have for my tinnitus, or what mm-hmm. what nutrient should I take for my eczema? And we're like, well, we don't, that's not the way we work. That's mm-hmm. allopathic herbalism, for lack
right.
of a better term. And that's not what we practice.
Right, exactly.
Wow. So there's so much I want you to share with people, but we focused on the technology at our event, and we focused on a lot of stuff on thyroid and adrenals, and people hear that all the time because of this stressed out society. And again, we see that a lot. Like, oh, here's the list of herbs you take for the adrenals, and what should I do for Hashimoto's, and what are the exact mm-hmm. processes? And so I'd love for you to share a little bit about the concept of adaptogens and how those work in terms of balancing hormones and adrenals mm-hmm. and thyroid, and we'd love to hear about that.
All right. Well, adaptogens are fascinating, and obviously, you know, this is a topic where I wrote the first book, basically, covering, you know, the entire topic of adaptogens. There had been books previously primarily on ginseng or a specific herb, but the reason I wrote the book was twofold. Basically, someone came to me and wanted to use one of my articles that I had already written on adaptogens and put it out as a pamphlet. And I said, well, no, that's my material. And I said, well, how about we write a book? And the idea of writing the book was that a lot of people, there's two problems in the herbal community. And I'll say the word herbal community, but really what I mean is not just herbal community. You can call it CAM medicine if you want, complementary alternative medicine, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just point out that any herbalist worth their salt is also working with diet and lifestyle and supplements and things like that. It's not just herbs, but you're using all of these things together. But anyway, there were two problems that I saw within the herbal community, and one was the word adaptogens. People were really, really being sloppy about this terminology, and the thing is that, you know, for a long time, herbal medicine, you know, I kid with people, and I said that when I was starting out, all my friends were interested in one herb, and I was interested in all the other ones. And, you know, people thought, you know, being an herbalist at the time, we're talking about the late 60s, people thought, you know, I was out of my mind. Why would I bother with something that kind of went out with, gas lights and ice for your refrigerator? But I fell in love with herbal medicine, and so it was my passion, and I did it even if it was not something that was popular. But one of the things that has happened in the herbal community is that there's a tremendous lack of, let's say, rigor when it comes to language. And so adaptogen is a definite term. It means something. And I started seeing people writing articles claiming cranberries were adaptogenic, and this was adaptogenic, and that was adaptogenic. And these things are not adaptogens at all. And so, first off, we had to, you know, I wanted to write the book to define what actually an adaptogen is, so people could know what it is and you start using the words precisely. Because, you know, for a long time, we were so far out in left field that, we could speak our own language. But the reality is anybody who's practicing any of these practices, any of these sort of complementary practices, and I actually don't like that word because I think in many cases they are quite first line in what they do. But one of the problems is that we need to be able to communicate with the greater world. We're not some obscure thing anymore. We need to be able to communicate with our brethren who are medical doctors and in other practices and other fields, because we don't want this to be something that is invisible. We want this to be something that is part of basically the culture of this country and in the world. So we need to, if we can't communicate amongst ourselves as to what a term means, how are we going to communicate that to someone else? And then the other side of the problem is that a lot of people have this idea, oh, you want an adaptogen, just pick one. There's a list. These are all adaptogens, pick one. And the answer to that is, oh, absolutely not. Some adaptogens are stimulating, some are calming, some are heating, some are cooling. And so you need to understand that all adaptogens are not created equal. And you want to use the adaptogen that is appropriate to the person who you are working with, not just any adaptogen. And that's the same thing whether we're talking about diaphoretics, whether we're talking about diuretics, whether we are talking about nervines. In each case, the better you can understand the specifics of that herb, or in this case what I would call the personality of that herb, the better you know whether it matches up to the person you are giving it to. So, for instance, one of the classic adaptogens is an herb called rhodiola. And rhodiola is a very effective herb, and I'll maybe get a chance to talk about it a little bit later, but it can overstimulate people. And so if you give it to somebody, you know, who says to you, oh, my God, if I have even like a tiny bit of caffeine after lunch, I can't sleep at night, don't give that person rhodiola.
Okay.
It'll keep them awake. And rhodiola is also very drying. So somebody who has yin deficiency, meaning they have a dry cough, dry mouth, dry eyes, vaginal dryness, dry skin, it'll make it worse. So you need to know the personality of the herb so that you can say, yes, this is the right adaptogen, not just any old adaptogen, but this is the right one for this person at this specific time. So what is an adaptogen? Well, the term was originally coined by Soviet researchers, and the guy who first started studying adaptogens was a man named Professor Lazarov. That work was taken over by a man named Israel Breckman, who is considered the father of adaptogens. And the Soviets weren't doing this as, you know, some kind-hearted gesture. They were looking for substances, primarily herbal, although they were looking at pharmaceuticals as well, that could help the organism adapt to stress more successfully. So they were looking for things that would make better cosmonauts, better workers, better soldiers, so that they could do what Nikita Khrushchev said, and that was bury the West. Well, the good news is, of course, the research goes beyond, you know, those uses. And you know, when we look at concepts of, or if we look at categories of herbs, I can't think of a category of herb that's probably more necessary and appropriate today than adaptogens, because adaptogens help us to adapt to stress. Have there ever been people in the world who weren't in an active war zone or something, you know, or facing, you know, famine or drought or flood or some other disaster, who were more stressed out than people in first world countries are today? We live in a crazy, incredibly complex, fast-paced world, and we do not handle stress all that well. And so adaptogens are the herbs that help to re-regulate the endocrine, immune, and nervous system function, and they primarily work through two systems, the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which sometimes is also looked at as the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal thyroid axis, and the SAS, the sympathoadrenal system, which is basically the flight or fight syndrome. So those two systems basically is primarily how adaptogens are working. And to further sort of define an adaptogen, adaptogens basically are non-toxic at the normal therapeutic dose. They help basically induce a state of non-specific resistance to stress, meaning they help against a wide variety of stressors, not just psychological stress, but physiological stress, noise stress, temperature extreme. Any type of stress, they help the organism adapt more effectively and more appropriately. And then finally, when you take an adaptogen, somebody who's really healthy can take an adaptogen, they won't notice much of an effect. Unlike a stimulant, which will stimulate somebody who's healthy or unhealthy, adaptogens in a healthy organism do very little because the organism is already healthy and well regulated. And so they work more effectively. The more an organism is disorganized or dysregulated, the more of an effect you see. And that effect is what would be called a systemic amphoteric effect, meaning they in general help to normalize overall function. Now, that doesn't mean that every adaptogen is appropriate for every person, and an example would be ashwagandha with Thania, which in this case, while it is an adaptogen, it stimulates the thyroid. So it is perfectly wonderful for somebody who has Hashimoto's thyroiditis, but it would be totally inappropriate for somebody with Graves' disease.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, adaptogens, in addition, there's relatively new research, and I've been talking to the publisher of my book, and probably in a year, year and a half, we will eventually come out with a new edition. But I'll tell you some of the things that are going to be in the book, and one of the things is that there's some really great new information about what adaptogens are doing. And it turns out that adaptogens are not just working via the HPA axis and the SAS, they are even working on a cellular level. And what they are doing is they are basically by upregulating certain heat shock proteins and something called a forkhead protein, they help prevent stress-induced mitochondrial dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is one of the reasons, for instance, adaptogens are so useful for conditions like chronic fatigue, immune deficiency syndrome, and fibromyalgia, where mitochondrial dysfunction are basically at the root of both of those conditions. So that's really, in my mind, rather exciting news because it's like we actually have evidence that these things are actually working on that cellular level, and which makes them, of course, even more valuable than we knew, and we knew that they were already incredibly valuable. So I think that that gives you at least some basic insight as to what an adaptogen does. And you know, when we look at adaptogens, I would say that there are about a dozen plants that we know are well-researched and we know are definitely adaptogens. We have probably about another 10 or so that are probably adaptogens, although the evidence is not quite as good. And then we have another maybe 10 that are possible adaptogens. The evidence is even more sketchy. And then there's a large list of plants that people have claimed at various times and places to be adaptogens, which I don't believe are adaptogens at all.
Mm-hmm. And so you lay that out in your book, like which ones are which.
Yes, and in the book we also talk about the specifics of each adaptogen, meaning what's the personality, what is it like, what does it do, when is it appropriate, so which ones are stimulating adaptogens, which ones are heating, or and most of the stimulating ones are heating, which ones are cooling, which ones are calming, so that you get a better sense of why you should be using that particular adaptogen rather than using that category.
Got it. Absolutely. And are there any that are really like, okay, these are good for everybody? I mean, you mentioned ashwagandha with the thyroid thing, but are there others like that absolutely, they're pretty neutral in their heat and their drying and all that could be used safely with most people?
Well, yeah, I'd say the closest to that would be Eleuthero, what used to be called Siberian ginseng. But the thing about Eleuthero is it's not one of the stronger ones. It's actually quite mild. And so I mostly use it for people who are in their late teens, 20s, and maybe even early 30s, where they still have all their original chi. They still have that original life force. But they are using it in a sense to, for instance, and just let's say one thing about adaptogens. Adaptogens are not something you take instead of living a healthy lifestyle. So, for instance, adaptogens won't make up for the fact that you are chronically sleep deprived. Adaptogens don't make up for the fact that somebody is eating really horrible diet. Adaptogens, where you really want to use them is so you have a young couple just has a baby. And they're not getting a lot of sleep. You could use adaptogens there to help you adapt to that a temporary stress-filled situation. Or you have somebody who's in college and they, you know, finals and they're going to be pulling some all-nighters studying. That you could use an adaptogen there. On the other hand, if you have somebody who is really abusing their body, adaptogens are simply going to help you actually abuse yourself a little bit longer until you collapse, in which case you'll probably collapse even more problematically and more dramatically than if you hadn't taken them at all. So adaptogens are not something you use as a crutch to sort of help you continue to live a very unhealthy lifestyle. It's something for people who are really trying to take care of themselves, but there are times in life, be it at work, be it in, you know, relationship, you know, just life, where things become, you know, incredibly stressful and you're going through a difficult period that you might not be able to eat as well. You might, your diet, your sleep may not be as good. Your work hours may be very long. And in those cases, adaptogens are phenomenal. And then, of course, adaptogens also, of course, help to re-regulate, as we said, most endocrine system functions. So we are talking about at the very base, we're going to be using adaptogens for people who are depressed. We're going to be using adaptogens for people who have autoimmune diseases. We're going to be using adaptogens for people who have cancer. We're going to be using adaptogens for people who have a wide variety of chronic degenerative diseases because they are going to help. They're not, maybe in many cases, they may not be the primary therapy, but they are going to help re-regulate, you know, we're talking about the entire endocrine system. So we're talking about not just adrenal function or hypothalamic function or pituitary function, but we're talking about the ovaries and the testes and the pancreas, and we're talking about thymus, and we're talking about all of the, you know, endocrine function. And let's not forget that we now know with the enteric gut that the intestine has endocrine function, and we now know that the heart has endocrine function. We even know that the bones have endocrine function. So all of these things are going to be affected by adaptogens, and then, of course, you bring in the fact that they also help re-regulate the nervous system function and much of the immune function as well. So they have a really broad sphere of activity, and there are, I'd say, more situations where I can think of using adaptogens than situations where I couldn't think of using an adaptogen. You know, I don't necessarily give an adaptogen for somebody who has an acute, influenza.
Right.
But for most people with chronic degenerative disease or chronic stress or chronic emotional issues, adaptogens are absolutely indicated.
Absolutely. So it seems to me that if people are just starting out in studying herbal medicine, and their best starting point would be to really learn the adaptogens because they have such a widespread use.
Well, you know, one of the nice things, and this is one of the things I actually did in my book, but is that I also paired adaptogens with several other classes of herbs that they work really well with. And so there are two other groups of herbs that I think adaptogens work really well with. One are the nervines. And nervines are herbs that are calming and help to basically rebuild the emotional foundation. So nervines are not sedatives. They're not basically, they don't knock you out and, you know, make you go to sleep. These are the things that basically help us to create a new calm exterior for people who become emotionally labile. And I think they work incredibly well with adaptogens. So this is herbs like fresh oat and skullcap and linden flower and hawthorn and motherwort and St. John's wort. So those type of herbs work really well with adaptogens. And then the other category I think that works really well are what are called nootropics. Nootropics enhance cerebral circulation. And so these are herbs, and many of them are also anxiolytic. So these are herbs like bacopa and herbs like white peony and eclipta and gotocola. And they, too, also work really well with adaptogens. And so I would say certainly, you know, you don't want to limit yourself. You want to learn about herbs on a broad basis for sure. But certainly learning about, for instance, those three classes of herbs can get you pretty far relatively quickly because it's a relatively small amount of information that you need to learn. And the beauty of herbs, and my students sometimes throw up their hands at this, but, you know, in my 2-year herb studies program, I teach people over 300 herbs in exquisite detail. And the reason is I think that that's a beginning level. A lot of other people will teach 50 or 75 or 100, but I want people, you know, I want people to have the right tool for the right job. And so it's a little bit like people saying, well, you know, if you only know 50 herbs really well. Well, yeah, but that's a little bit like saying if you need a coping saw and saying all you got is a chainsaw, yeah, you'll make do. Not really. So you really want the right tool, in this case, the right herb for the right situation. And but those three categories of herbs would be great. And then, you know, of course, from there, I would go into things affecting digestion because, to me, that is always a foundational thing.
Foundation, absolutely. Wow, this is awesome information, and I'm really excited to have you sharing it. So Let's talk about something that so many of us see Ike all the time. It's almost like it's epidemic. I don't know if you've noticed that over your 40 years of practicing, that it's just become epidemic, but thyroid issues, right? It's like everybody knows even what the thyroid is, whereas years ago you go, wow, what's that to the lay public? So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, you're right. In the 38 years that I've been in clinical practice, I've seen lots of things where the incidence has increased dramatically, and I would say thyroid is one of them, especially hypothyroidism. I've also seen incredible increase in autoimmune disease, allergy. But so let's focus in on the thyroid. There are numerous reasons why we're seeing more greater incidence of thyroid issues. Number one, and I just mentioned, is that we're also seeing greater incidence of autoimmune disease. So that means both Hashimoto's thyroiditis and Graves' disease. We see both of these at a much greater incidence in women, especially postmenopausal women, although you don't need to be postmenopausal, nor do you need to be female to experience either one of these conditions. One of the issues that I see with these is that a lot of Americans are, among other things, iodine deficient. And, you know, you would think with the amount of salt that Americans eat and the fact that a lot of it is iodized, that iodine deficiency would be a thing of the past. And, of course, a lot of Americans eat seafood these days, even if they don't live right by the ocean, because, you know, you can get fresh seafood at your supermarket and things like that. But what a lot of people don't realize is that there are a number of iodine antagonists that are commonly in our environments, and by that I mean in our homes, things like chlorine, bromine, fluoride, fluorine. All of these things basically compete with iodine. And so iodine deficiency is actually not uncommon at all. And, in fact, one of the problems we see with most Americans is that we see people who are overfed and undernourished. And so we see people with a range of deficiencies. I mean, I have patients, and I'm looking at their blood work, and they come in with a vitamin D level of 8.
Oh, I've had that too.
8. I mean, at that level, you can get rickets.
Yeah.
So we see people with vitamin D deficiencies, with zinc and selenium deficiencies. And selenium, by the way, is also essential for the conversion of L-tyrosine into TSH. And so, actually, no, into T3 and T4. So, I mean, there are numerous issues here. We have lots and lots of deficiencies of essential nutrients. And specifically with the thyroid, we would be looking at primarily selenium and iodine. So I think that plays a significant role, and there are other factors as well. And one of the other factors, of course, is ionizing radiation and exposure to ionizing radiation, which has also become much more common. So I think that those are some of the sort of causative things, and there is some evidence that certain things that are in the diet may also play a role. So we have certain things that basically are thyroid inhibitors, or in this case thyroxin inhibitors, such as uncooked brassicas and some of your soy. I see some people who kind of become what I would call soyitarians, and they're, you know, it's like fermented soy is a wonderful, wonderful food. But I'm not a huge fan of isolated soy isoflavones or lots and lots of soy protein and things like that. And we see people, you know, consuming huge amounts of these things simply because, of course, they've been told it's good for them and things like that. So I think all of those things are potential issues. Now, when it comes to herbs, we have herbs that can be useful for both hypothyroidism, and we have herbs that can be used for hyperthyroidism, but they're entirely different. So you wouldn't be using the same herbs for each condition. And of course, if there is also an autoimmune component, so Hashimoto's or Graves, then you're dealing with the autoimmune issue as well. And one of the things that I'll point out, and I'm sure many of the listeners know this, but people used to think that autoimmune disease was simply an immune excess condition, and that actually in most cases is not true. We all have really good evidence to show that most people with autoimmune diseases have prematurely aged immune systems. So you basically have a condition where you have immune hypoactivity and immune hyperactivity occurring all at the same time.
Yeah.
And there is a specific class of herbs that I would call immune amphoterics that are specific for treating those type of conditions. And because they are not immune stimulants, they are not basically suppressing immune function, what they're doing is helping to nourish and strengthen the immune system so that it can regain its normal regulatory capacity. And you just don't find that there's, you know, there really isn't many things outside of the herbal world that have the ability to actually do that.
Right.
And so those are really important. And even though I'm not going to specifically talk about that group of herbs unless you want me to.
Certainly mention a few if you want to, yeah.
Well, the good news is that some of these herbs are also adaptogens. Not all adaptogens are immune amphoterics, but some of them are. So, for instance, ashwagandha is an immune amphoteric. So it certainly can be used, but it's also a thyroid stimulant. So in that case, you would use it for hypoactive thyroid. Again, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and it will help downregulate the autoimmune component of the disease while also stimulating the thyroid. So that one would be really appropriate. Some of our other adaptogens like American ginseng, Asian ginseng, Eleuthero, Schizandra, are all reishi, are all immune amphoterics, meaning they help to re-regulate the immune system. So one of the beauties about herbs is that most herbs have multiple activities. They just don't affect one tissue, one organ, or do one thing. So one of the things that you do as a good herbalist, or hopefully even a great herbalist, is you look at things and you look at the person and you say, okay, I need this, and I need this, and this, and you can often find one herb. Not that you're only using one herb, because we have complicated patients, so we put together complex formulas, but you can often find one herb that will do three of the things that you want to do, and then maybe this other herb will do two, and this other herb will do several things as well, so that you don't have to have a formula that has 20 or 30 herbs in it, and you don't have to give somebody 20 different bottles of herbs. You can make up a formula that basically they're taking a formula or maybe a tea and a tincture at the same time so that it's simple and easy. One of the things, the mistakes I see a lot of practitioners make, and this is going back, I used to, back in 1976, 77, 78, I used to manage a health food store in Manhattan. And one of my jobs was as the staff herbalist, nutritionist sort of thing, as there were a lot of nutritionally oriented physicians who would send their patients into our store to pick up their supplements. And these people would come in and buy shopping bags full of vitamins. I mean, just hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of vitamins. And today we're talking that would be thousands of dollars worth. And my job was to explain to them why they were taking all this stuff. And one of the things I noticed is for many of these people, they would come in and it's like, you know, they've been on this stuff for 6 months, 8 months, a year, and they weren't getting any better.
Wow.
And a lot of the people would get very frustrated because, you know, they'd have like little chests of all their vitamins, you know, and they'd be taking handfuls at breakfast and handfuls at lunch and handfuls at dinner. And it's like the more complicated you make it, the less likely people are going to be compliant, and, of course, the more expensive it becomes. So we always need to remember, who are we working with? And, yes, you want the best for them, but I will just remind people, the simpler you can keep it, and certainly money is an object for many people, those are things you always have to keep in account, because if something will work for somebody but they can't afford it, then it doesn't help them. And if something's too complicated for somebody to continue to do, it's not going to help them. And so one of the great things about herbs is you can blend them together to create very complex formulas, but it's one tincture or one tea.
Right, right. That's what's awesome about it. Super.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, let's get back to thyroid. That's great.
That's what I
would love.
That's what I was going to say. So anyway, getting back to thyroid, so you have certain herbs that stimulate the thyroid. And as I was saying before, probably the best single herb I know for stimulating the thyroid is ashwagandha. So these are the herbs you'd be using for somebody with hypothyroidism. Ashwagandha, bacopa, which is also a nootropic and anxiolytic, also stimulates the thyroid. You have things like gum gugel, which basically enhances peripheral conversion of T4 into T3. A lot of people who want to stimulate the thyroid will give people seaweeds, and that's okay, except what you need to understand is iodine is you need just right. In most cases, you know, if you take a little bit too much, a little bit too little, not a big deal. But with iodine, on the other hand, if you take too much iodine, it actually inhibits the thyroid. And, of course, if you don't have enough iodine, it inhibits the thyroid. So the key with things like seaweeds is to use them either dietarily or as a supplement, but don't take huge amounts. You don't want large amounts of iodine either as an isolated mineral or in the form of seaweed. But some of the other benefits of some seaweeds is that many seaweeds contain precursor compounds, including things like L-tyrosine, which are used as starting material for the manufacture of T3 and T4 of thyroxin. So those things are also really useful. So those are some of the herbs that we would use to try to stimulate the thyroid. Now, there are others. There's an herb called blue flag, Iris versicolor. Iris, though, is not an herb I want beginners using. Iris can have some toxicity in overdose, and so I would want somebody to be fairly skilled before they decided to start using iris for people. All the other herbs I mentioned are all quite moderate in their effects and quite safe.
Okay, so we don't have to worry too much about the hot, cold, dry, moist.
Well, I think that you... If you really want to be good, you always pay attention to that.
Okay.
Again, the one that I mentioned that you have the biggest or most significant issue with is don't give ashwagandha to somebody who has hyperthyroid activity.
Exactly.
And then for people who are hyperthyroid, we have a number of herbs that basically inhibit thyroxin. And probably the strongest herb that we have that does that is an herb called bugleweed or lycopis. And it is usually paired with lemon balm, Melissa, and motherwort, Leonoris. Those three herbs are often given in combination for people who have hyperthyroidism. And they work for mild to moderate hyperthyroidism. On the other hand, somebody who has a really severe hyperthyroid condition, you know, then you may be in the realm of doing the you know, the radioactive nucleotides to basically destroy the thyroid and everything, because herbs probably will not work at that point. But for mild to moderate cases, it can actually be very, very successful. And that's a simple formula that I have used in, I don't know, 50, 60, 80 different cases over the years, probably. I'm estimating because I don't really remember how many, but it's been quite a number, where we've been able to basically, and along with those immune amphoterics, to control things like Graves' disease.
Okay. And that's an important part, right? I think that making sure that you're not just treating autoimmune thyroid as a thyroid condition, that you have to work on the immune system and get that balance.
Well, you have to, because it's not just, you know, you basically have the immune system attacking the thyroid. And so, therefore, if you don't downregulate the abnormal or disordered immune response, then the other things that you do are not going to be particularly effective. Now, on the other, I'll also say that in my 38 years of experience, for the most part, you don't cure autoimmune diseases. You control them. And so I can say that the vast majority of autoimmune diseases that I've treated respond really well and are controllable, but most of them don't go away and then it's like, okay, it's gone. You have to continue to treat them for, in most cases, the rest of the person's life.
Right. So as soon as you stop, it comes back.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And the diet is super important, as we all
well,
know, for the autoimmune.
Yeah. Diet is extremely important. You know, I've just finished revising one of my papers on autoimmune disease, and it is incredibly fascinating just how complicated the immune system is, and how, you know, years ago we had what was the initial hygiene hypothesis with the, you know, TH1 and TH2, and it turns out that was, you know, a gross oversimplification of the immune system. But what we do know is that when we have, for instance, a healthy immune system, you have dendritic cells, and the dendritic cells basically create a pro-tolerogenic state, meaning you're able to tolerate. And this is true for both allergies and autoimmune disease. There are numerous things that can basically disrupt things like dendritic cells and things like Th17 cells, which, by the way, are absolutely essential for autoimmune disease. If you don't have overactive Th17 cells, you don't have autoimmune disease. And so some of the things that are underlying factors here, vitamin D. Vitamin D, of course, is incredibly important. We already talked about how we see so many people who are deficient. And personally, you know, if you look at the standard test, it says anything above 32 is fine. I prefer to see people I work with have blood serum levels over 50. I personally think 32 is not really an adequate level of vitamin D. It's just that, you know, most people are afraid of the sun, so they're not getting adequate vitamin D, and it's very difficult to get from your diet.
Absolutely. I agree. I push it up higher. People with autoimmune, I like it to be 75 or between.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm saying that for me, minimum's 50. Mm-hmm. is my minimum. But yeah, absolutely, I like to see people at much higher levels, you know. And this is something that's been known a long time. The further you go from the equator, the more autoimmune disease you see.
Mm-hmm.
And vitamin D plays a huge role there. So vitamin D is extremely important. Then you have other issues, for instance, like leaky gut syndrome, where you have you basically have lost the tight junctures in the gut mucosa. And that pushes autoimmune diseases. Things like reactivated Epstein-Barr virus is a major, potentially major contributing factor to autoimmune diseases. And so there's a whole bunch of things going on. And so certainly when we have somebody with an autoimmune disease, we want to look at diet. We want to get things that are dietary allergens, which are basically antigens, out of their diet. I usually start with the simple ones, and the simple ones are, you know, casein and gluten.
Mm-hmm.
I don't start with them at the same time. I always check one and do an elimination diet and then do the other one and see what kind of response I get. And one of the problems, I think, with a lot of people who do elimination diets, they don't do them long enough.
Right.
And some cases you really need to do it for a considerable period of time to really get a sense of just how that person's going to respond. And, of course, there are other things that you might want to look at. But, you know, those are simple, simple things that people can do. So diet, let's not forget the importance of sleep. In 1910, the average American slept over 9 hours a night. Now the average American sleeps less than 7 hours a night. In the intervening 100 years, we haven't evolved to need less sleep. We're just chronically sleep deprived.
Right.
And people who think that they can only get 5 or 6 hours of sleep during the week and then they'll catch up on weekends, studies have clearly shown that catching up doesn't work.
Yeah.
So sleep is essential. Exercise is essential. A good diet is essential. And I'm astonished. I am astonished at what the average person thinks is a good diet.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we see huge issues with, you know, in this country with metabolic syndrome.
Yeah.
So, you know, the whole thing is these things, as with anything, are multifaceted. And so we just don't throw herbs at it. We just don't throw supplements. We are looking at a whole person, and we are looking at how can we help them to change their life so that that person can regain their health, be the healthiest person they, you know, possibly can be. And it's astonishing. You know, in my two-year study, herb studies program, in my first class, there's something I tell people, and I said, listen, if you only do 5 things, half of your patients will get better.
Yep.
Now, the bad news is that the other half are much more complicated. But if you only do 5 things, and the 5 things are clean up the person's diet, number 2, get them to sleep, number 3, get them to exercise, number 4, listen to them, listen to their story. There are people out there who are dying to tell their story. You know, and number 4, 5, give them bitters.
Yeah.
Bitters, in my mind, is the most physiologically active taste. And you give somebody bitters, and it enhances digestion, it enhances absorption, it enhances elimination. And then people come back to you and they say, oh, I started taking those bitters like 2 weeks ago, and my skin cleared up, my arthritis got better, my headaches felt better, my bowels have improved. And it's like, yep, absolutely.
Yep. Can you just share with people how you do it? I've given them, they've heard my story on how I usually give bitters, but I'd love to hear yours. I think mine is based on yours, so.
Well, basically, most bitters are really cold. And so initially, if you use a cold bitter, it actually stimulates digestion, but your stomach is hot, 104 degrees. And so therefore, if you only use cold bitters, eventually you damp down stomach fire. So a good bitters, it can be made two ways. You either combine cooling bitters with warming bitters, and there are not that many warming bitters. Things like Angelica, which is my favorite, orange peel, turmeric, fenugreek, those are some of the major warming bitters. So you combine warming bitters with cooling bitters to create a bitters formula that is something that will be sustainable and can be used literally at every meal for the rest of your life. Or you combine bitters with basically spice or herbs. So you'd make what's called a spice bitter. You combine it with things like cinnamon or ginger, which are also warming. And I usually have people take bitters. You don't need a lot, 5 or 10 drops, 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes before meal. If it's too stimulating, you can actually take it with the meal, but generally I prefer to, you know, and what bitters do is when you take a bitter, there are receptors in your tongue that do nothing but taste for bitters. And by the way, remarkably, they have found now that there are bitter receptors in other parts of the body, including your lungs.
Mm.
Really interesting. They're not entirely sure what this means, but they've found them. And so bitters, you know, they stimulate, you have these receptors on your tongue, and as soon as you taste that bitter, your saliva production increases, which, of course, saliva is not just to make your mouth moist, it's a digestive fluid. It increases gastric HCl secretion. It increases secretion of small intestine enzymes and juices, pancreatic enzymes and juices, bile secretion, bile excretion. And so literally the entire process of digestion, absorption, and elimination is enhanced by bitters. So as I said before, after I talked about the three categories, I said next would be digestion, and that's actually what we're talking about, is to enhance digestion. Because I don't care how good your diet is, I don't care how clean it is, I don't care how organic it is, if you can't absorb it, and in fact, you know, the old expression is you are what you eat. One of my early teachers was a remarkable herbalist named William LeSassier, and William used to say, you are what you don't excrete. And I would take it one step further, and I'd say, you are what you absorb. So what you eat is certainly important, but if you can't absorb the nutrients, even the best foods do you very little good.
Right.
And so stimulating digestion and absorption is a key, because that's, of course, where all that, what in Chinese medicine is called guqi, or the grain qi, the life force. So you can call it vitamins, minerals, enzymes, whatever you want to call it. You need to be able to absorb that. And that's actually one of my reasons that even though I'll use herbs in encapsulated forms and things like that, I prefer herbs as a tea or a tincture, which is an alcohol and water extract, because you bypass digestive function. They basically are absorbed sublingually. And I have to say, clinically, I'd say only about 60 to 65% of my patients have significant GI digestive issues. And I don't think that my group of people, my practice, is atypical.
Mm-hmm.
So many people, one time I was at this place, and there was a large number of people there, and they had big bank of porta-johns. And I started talking to the guy. He was there to clean them and everything, and I started talking to him. And we got in this conversation, and he says, you know what we find in these things more than you know anything else beyond what you think you're going to find in a porta-john? I said, no, what? He said, undigested vitamins. Said tons of them. And so, again, the key is, one of the keys is absorption, what you get. And so that's one of the reasons I like liquids so much, is because
too.
The absorption is so much better. And you'll hear all this stuff about standardized herbs. Here's a great one. I'm sure all of our listeners have heard about curcumin. Curcumin is, quote-unquote, the active ingredients of turmeric, which is curcuma longa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the world's leading researcher on curcumin having a conversation, and what he said was is that in lab studies, in vitro studies, curcumin is about 30 times more absorbable than turmeric. He said, but in vivo, in living organisms, the difference totally disappears. And since they identified the curcuminoids as the active ingredient in turmeric, they've identified at least 15 to 20 additional active constituents that are not in the curcumin products. They actually just recently had a study that they'd done with a curcumin-free turmeric extract. It had no curcumin in it, and it had anti-tumor activity, anti-inflammatory activity.
Wow.
And I have to tell you, clinically, I get better results using ground-up turmeric as a powder than I often get with curcumin, and I get even better results with tincture.
Wow. What about fresh? I mean, it's hard to get, but do you...
It's hard to get, and it's not the best-tasting thing in the world.
No, it's not.
So I probably would not generally use it that way.
Great. Oh, this is awesome. I want to quickly ask you one question about the bitters, and then I'd love you to tell people a little bit about what, you know, what resources you have in your two-year class and all that. But as far as the bitters, I always recommend people, if they want to get the tincture, they get yours, the Herbalist and Alchemist one, because I just
like the
way it's balanced between the cooling and the warming. And some of our people live in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, so they could just walk into their local health food store and get it. But otherwise,
we do actually have stores all over the country that have our products. Oh yeah,
I haven't seen them at like our Whole Foods or any of those.
Well, we don't deal with Whole Foods.
Okay.
Whole Foods is not so easy to deal with, especially if you're a small company. But you know what? If you keep going to your local health food store and asking them to get our products, they probably will.
They'll get them, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the thing I like about it, you know, I'm just not saying it to plug David's products. It's because his all these years of herbal research and his knowledge and all what he shares in his two-year program and what I learned was all about balance in formulas. Like some of them need higher alcohol, some of them need lower alcohol. You want to balance your warm and your cool, and the formulations that he puts out are based on his, you know, 40 years of in-depth eclectic herbal research. So that's why I love to get his products. And so I'd love to be able to send people to go get them. They're just a little – ask for them at your health food store. But the question I had about the bitters is that oftentimes I'll tell people, well, you know, if you like, just take a few of the bitter greens out of your salad and just chew them and chew them and chew them and chew them and chew them until they become pulpy and they release their juices. And you can do that in lieu of the bitters. But is that really, is that a good idea? Does it work as effectively?
If it tastes bitter, it is bitter. So if you like broccoli rabe, if you like arugula, things like that, you can just chew them up. And actually, as long as you get that hit of bitterness in your mouth, that's all you need. So, you know, you don't have to get fancy about it. You don't have to necessarily take a product. You could... I mean, in the Caribbean, they used to do what they take a tree called quassia, and they'd take on a lathe, they'd make a cup out of it, and it's called a bitter cup. You just pour water in it and let it sit for an hour, and it turns crazy bitter, and you just drink a little bit of it.
Awesome. Okay, great. So I'm not giving people, you know, I just wanted to be concerned about the cooling versus the warming in there. Yeah.
Well, those in that case, those are cooling bitters, that's for sure. But, you know, they could always take something warming with it, like a little ginger or something.
Put a little
like
cayenne
that.
Or ginger on your dandelion while you chew it before your meal. Or ginger juice. People use a lot of ginger juice for inflammation. But so that's great to know. And then the other thing is, tell us about your program. This is a two-year program that I went through. Online. I did the online version of it, and it was awesome.
Well, the two-year program basically is designed for people who want to become clinical herbalists, whether they're already medical professionals. About half my students are either physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, as I said before, dentists, nutritionists, also massage therapists. And the other half are people who simply are fascinated with herbs and want to become a clinical herbalist. The program is probably one of the most in-depth programs that exists in the United States that I'm aware of, and it's one of the only ones where you can either be live in class or live online. So we have students now all over the United States, Canada, England, Ireland, Luxembourg, Australia. And it's live, so you get to, you know, ask questions, and your questions are answered, just like if you were actually in class. And we have been evolving and refining this. This is our, I think, our fourth time we've done the two-year program online. And each time we do it, it gets better, and we've figured out, you know, we have an incredible student portal. There's a Ask the Professor where you can ask questions in between classes. And we spend a lot of time, I give people what I consider three different sets of toolboxes and teach them about basic introduction to Chinese medicine, Cherokee medicine, eclectic medicine. We teach them herbs from around the world, so that you can learn Chinese herbs and Western herbs and European herbs and Native American herbs and all from all around the world. But the idea is to give you this really good set of tools so that you understand the herbs, and of course not only understanding the herbs but understanding how to apply them to the person. So we also do things like differential diagnosis so that you have the skill set that you need to sit there and say, okay, I've got a person sitting in front of me. How do I figure out who this person is and what this person needs? So our focus is not treating disease, it's treating people. We also have aspects of the program which include herbal pharmacy, how to do, you know, simple medicine making, field botany, so you can learn to identify plants. I'm not trying to teach people to be, wildcrafters or medicine makers, but I don't want to turn people out who know nothing about these things either. I think if you have the basic knowledge of how to make medicine, you're going to probably have a better sense of whether something you're going to get for your patients or your clients is any good. I don't want to have somebody who simply thinks dandelion comes out of a bottle. I want people to be able to, you know, look at one and say, oh, yeah, that's a dandelion, that's mugwort, that's chickweed, that's yarrow. And so the program, as I said, is 2-year program. This next program will be the last one where I am the primary teacher. Now I teach about 75% of the program, and after that I'm hoping to go down to probably less than 20% after that. So if somebody wants to study with me, next program would be the time to do it. We're taking applications now, and we'll be starting to interview people over probably April through July. And the class will fill up, no doubt about that whatsoever. And it's a remarkable class, and I guess you would be probably a better person to say what you think about it because you've taken it. But then we offer 2 1-year programs to go beyond that for people, you know, want to gain more clinical skills, and one's called the graduate program, and one's called the therapeutics program, and those we hope to continue. And then starting hopefully in 2015, I'm going to start doing clinical intensives where people can do it online or come and study with me, and there'll be like 3 or 4 days on a specific topic and go as in-depth as I possibly can.
Right, and you'll take small groups of people with those?
And then at our websites, we have several, and I think they're up on the board for people to look at. We have the Herbalist Training Program. That's the herbalist.org website or .net. No, herbalist.net. I can't even remember.
I think it's .net, but the link is over on the side. Just
the link's on the side, and then there's one for Herbalist and Alchemist, and then my site, Herbal Therapeutics, which has all sorts of books that you can, you know, from my library, which is one of the largest private herbal research libraries in the United States, all sorts of books you can download and look at, and books that you'll never find in you know, hard copy. So, the goal here is to make herbal medicine a part of a mainstream American culture once again. And I hope everyone listening has found this to be useful, and it's been my pleasure to spend this time with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I know how busy your life is and how busy your schedule is, and I just feel honored that you took the time out to spend and be with us today.
Well, I'm glad that I could, and it's been great.
Great. Well, thank you, and I'm going to open up the lines for people so they could just, you know, there's not as many on the line as there are listening in, but you guys can express your appreciation. Let's give David a big, you know, rah-rah cheer, and you're
thank
on
you.
Open.
Thank you. Thank
you.
You're
very welcome.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, David.
All right. Take care.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
The moderator has left the conference.